culture, Christ and cross-cultural mission, with an emphasis on trying to understand what culture is, how Christ relates to it. And we talked about Christ and Tanzanian culture. So we'll continue that now. But as we go along, I want to try to point out a little bit to what I think and what we think it means that Christ and his church are present in a country like Tanzania. What kind of a church is emerging? What kind of a church would we expect to have fellowship with a culture like this? We talked about their culture and their religion under the title Religion of Relationship. There are some anthropologists who say that Africans don't really have a religion. They just have a culture with a mystic thrust to it. I don't think that's true. But nevertheless, when you're talking about their culture, you are also talking about their religion. They can't separate them. So we talked about creation, this holistic universe where the invisible and the visible penetrate, interpenetrate. And every time you experience something visible, you are reminded and in touch with something invisible. Now we talked about sickness and health, and how that ties in with relationship, because health is mainly this secret power of good in the universe that is finding its way out to people through designated clan people, ancestor spirits. And sickness is really caused by disruptions in society and in human relations. They have a number of ways whereby the relations are restored so that health can come again. When we quit yesterday, we were talking about person and community, and we don't talk long about these two, so let's spend a little longer on this one. And then maybe even a little bit in the end about, I want to ask you some questions about our culture and what do you think it means when we've studied about Christ and Tanzanian culture to look at ours. We had talked about birth, its importance as a continuation of the clan, and we had talked about puberty. Last night, Tom mentioned that the greatest transition in the life of any person is the age of puberty. Africans have known this and practiced rituals that are concerned with this from way, way back. Probably one of the things you will see if you go to Tanzania, I hope you don't see it, but you might, along the road, some young boys all painted up with white around their faces and feathers and back, and they'll be jumping up and down trying to get your attention so that you'll take their picture and they can get a few shillings. Most of my Tanzanian friends think this is a terrible tragedy in the light of what circumcision should mean, because these are in circumcision camp days, men that are boys that are dressed up like this. And it has great meaning with great significance, and it shouldn't be flaunted just for a few shillings to passers-by. In fact, it's supposed to be, most of the wisdom is supposed to be secret. The circumcision rites, which bundle up together the meaning of the transition from youth to adult, are very significant. It really means that now you are accepted as an adult, now you are ready to think of marriage, and before that you couldn't have. Nobody would marry someone who hadn't been circumcised, whether male or female. So the regular circumcision and its attendant educational procedures are put great pressure on. If we're talking about the Tanzania that we experienced and we think is still strongly there, especially in the rural areas, the peer pressure is great. There is no way where that's going to let up for quite a long time. Even the female circumcision, the excision of the clitoris, that's continuing, very strongly. We have a very real friend, Mama Pearson, I don't know how he got that name, an evangelist in the South Maasai, and he told how he tried to keep his daughter from this, because many of them realize that that operation is detrimental to enjoying the sex act. And so they have learned enough to say that we want to try to keep our daughters from, but no way he could do it. She says, I must be like the rest of my peers, you know. And Josefina and Emanuele, real good friends of ours, evangelists going from one difficult place to another in the church in Tanzania. When we talked to them about this, their daughter was then about 4 years old. And they said, we are even now trying to figure out ways where we can get around this. Huh? And the only way they could think of is that when she comes to that age, they're going to move to another area completely and maybe make people think that she has already gone through this. So it's strong. It's not a thing that's dying out quickly. And it has great significance and has many good things about it. The educational value, the bonding, the age group that is formed at that time. Men like Bruno Gutmann, the German who did work in West Kilimanjaro, for example, he used the age groups all through the life of the church. He used them for the confirmation, he used them for everything, all the way down. The age groups were extremely significant, and they're formed in circumcision time.
Do many of the women die from infection as a result of that?
Yeah, I think a very, very few, but it happens. But also the men, because there's a spilling of blood as well. The last one I went to, they had the local medical assistant come over with sterile equipment and do it. Huh? Now that's quite a change. Huh?
For the men,
yeah.
But
not for the women. No stranger would get in on that in any way. Anyway, with its good and with its bad, with its question marks and with its pluses, it's there and it's very strong. And it has a very significant place in the life of their society because it's a bonding in age groups. It's a passing from childhood into adulthood, and the bonding is accomplished by pain. They must stoically submit to the knife without a wince. Huh? Just, you know, I've seen them, and how they do it, I don't know. But they can stand it without blinking an eye. And if they don't, then of course it's shame on the father and so forth. Well, do you have anything you want to say about that before I go on to marriage and parenthood?
I have a question about it. Yeah. Is that cultural commitment to that style of initiation as strong in the larger communities as it is in the smaller ones?
Yeah, in the sense, if you mean by communities, ethnic communities. Yes.
Population.
Oh,
in that
the only places probably where it's being questioned is, well, even in the towns it's not questioned because that's an amalgam of different tribes coming and then they form their little tribal cliques in the towns. Huh? Oh. And they'll go back home for their circumcision. The female circumcision is now very much on the way out in Chaga land around Kilimanjaro. And that's because that area has had the most education and the most Christianity for a long time, and the women themselves have stood up and said, we don't want this for our daughters. And that's no problem once they decide, because they're the ones that do it. They're the ones that handle the education and the operation and everything. So in Chaga land, it is on the way out, but it's the only place I know, and that's one of the biggest, most advanced tribes in Tanzania.
Is there ostracization in a smaller community where people might refuse to have the operation?
Oh yeah, not in the sense that they won't let you be there and eat and that, but you can't be married, for example. Who'll be engaged to someone who wasn't circumcised? They say that person isn't an adult, huh?
Well, couldn't they do away with that type of thing and still have the bonding?
Well, sure, I think they could, and I think they will eventually. I'm sure that in Chagaland now, the women still have the educational rights for their kids. And in some places, that's melded with confirmation. It just depends on how strong the church is. The Chaga land is the closest to a folk church in Africa. The Germans did the job so well when they went there, the German Lutherans, that by far the great majority of people are Christian. And in an area like that, I think that you find that often some of those instructions that went along with circumcision are brought in with confirmation, and some of the old people are invited to come in and do part of the instruction. Elaine and I took a Chaga friend home one time to visit her folks, and we had she was a good friend, a worker with us, and we drove 75 miles to visit and drink tea with them and that, and we have never forgotten the argument that her mother had with her uncle while we were drinking tea. The uncle said that there are 6 non-Christians in the whole old Moshi area. And the mother said, no, that's wrong, there are 4. So that gives you an idea how thorough this program of the Germans was. You know, the Germans, when they do something, they do it. And in areas like that, the changes are more apt to be. But even so, it's been 100 years since the first German missionaries came to that area.
Yeah. I just want to tell you that I have a German mother, and she always told us kids, there's one way to do a job. Do it right in the first place. You don't have to do it over.
That's right. Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah. Well, now I want to move on to marriage and parenthood. I'm going to take these two together, marriage and parenthood, because as you'll see, they're just almost the same thing. I'll just give you a couple statements first, which I think tell the traditional African view regarding marriage. First, marriage is not a marriage without children. So you've got a right to give your wife back to her clan if she doesn't bear, if you want to. You don't have to, but certainly you're expected to get another one then that will bear. And that's probably the root cause of polygamy in the beginning. Other things have come in along the way, like simple lust, and old men trying to be young again, and a few things like this. But I think its basic cause has been this, to see that there were children. Another statement, a person is not an adult until he or she is a parent. There is the adulthood that comes with the circumcision rite, but to be a complete adult and accepted with adult responsibility and positions in the society, you should have a child or have sired one.
What's the ratio of men to women?
That's a good question. I don't really remember the last census. Not much difference, but the one before that, I remember. It was only about 5 to 7% more women than men. But that's interesting. That was there was a surplus of women in the Northwest area, and the Zanzibar Island had a surplus of men. Otherwise, all over everywhere else is around pretty much the same, you know. And so obviously, polygamy is restricted just for biological reasons. And not everybody has plural wives. You've got to be sort of a big deal, as Witt said, to have more than one wife, because you got to be able to handle the thing properly.
But if you aren't a person, you don't have a person without parenthood, then you can see why everybody would want one, and they would resent somebody who had more and down the availability.
Well, the main thing is that you get some children, and particularly some male children. I would say that the biggest problem we've had in the church with marriage, the church opted for monogamous marriage as the goal. They never said it had to happen all at once, but the church made several studies and they thought this is the way to go. Yet, if we've had problems, it's been when people have married and then not have had children. Then they're apt to revert to the old customs.
What's the average family size? How many children do they have as well? Is there any restriction on that at all?
No, there's no restriction, but what did we say, 6?
It's like 7.8.
Yeah, 7 something.
Children.
Yeah. Even, you know, when they started getting excited about the population explosion, even the father of the nation, Nyerere, even said, he thought 6 per family was a pretty good idea. Well, that sort of blew it all, because that doesn't do much to hold the population down. Because
cutting it down. Well, we can.
Yeah, to cut it, it helps, but the picture still looks pretty bleak, huh?
Do they use birth control?
Only when they have reached an educational and economic level whereby they see an advantage in having lesser children, giving them more freedom to do other things. But that's a very small number of the people, very small.
Have they not considered the possibility that lack of children could be the male's fault?
Yeah, they have been taught that, like all of us, you know, but they made up their mind 1,000 years ago. And so culture is strong.
You can't give the husband back.
No. No. Most husbands that we tried to get to the hospital because of this to be tested refused to do it. And we think that there are, we know that there are cases where by secret they know they're impotent, but they farm their wife out to a neighbor but don't tell anybody. You know, and hide under a tent.
Wow. So,
we had one of our most faithful elders of the church, Moses and Elizabeth, and Elizabeth was barren. And after I left, I heard that Moses had taken another wife. And now when I went back there in 91, Moses was back with Elizabeth because the other wife was didn't bear children
either. Where?
In Tanzania.
Oh, yeah. See, he's my brother, and we were there at the same time.
I lived on the plateau down in central Tanzania. We stayed there 25 years, and he was up in the mall.
The third statement I have, a person lives well after death by sacrificial remembrance by his children on his grave annually. And this gives having children ontological significance. You see, your life after death is dependent on having enough children, particularly male children, who will remember you for a long time. And they say that remembrance goes for 4 or 5 generations. And then they say, after that, what happened? They say, we don't know. Everyone sort of sinks into a pool of immortality then. But as long as you're remembered on earth sacrificially by your children, that means you will have a healthy life after death, not just a mere survival. And so this is very important to them, this business of having children. Thus, marriage is seen as uniting or as continuing the clans. Huh? The continuity of the clan is at stake when people are married, and that's why they must have children. So it's not just the two people who are married, but the families get together as well, and the families are united. And that's really the purpose of the bride wealth. Huh? You know, we usually say they're just buying their wives. That's not really, really, it might be crassly that someone gets money hungry and says, I put a lot of money into that girl, I want a lot of, it might happen, but it's not normally. Normally, the bride wealth is very carefully structured according to their area, and it means that the groom and his family give to the bride's family gifts. It's usually phased. It begins and continues. And it's a way of saying thank you for bringing this person up and caring for her. And it's a way of uniting these two clans. Because in case of divorce or separation, they have to bring that money back. And so they'll do everything they can, or not, maybe it isn't money, maybe it's cows, maybe it's goats, you know. And so they'll do everything they can to keep this thing a healthy relationship.
Are there periodic ceremonies to demonstrate the fact that ancestral dead are remembered?
Oh yeah, oh yes, oh yes, oh yes, yeah. Yeah, we talked a little bit about that yesterday, huh? But it's not unusual at all for Africans, just when you're talking with them in a class or something, to talk about how they believe they were visited by an ancestor in a dream, for example, and that sort of thing. Who?
Are these planned marriages, or are they marriages of love, or what?
Well, both. Love, you know, that's a difficult one to define, huh? But Let's say that, that traditionally the African family has always had a quite a bit to do with the choice, but not solely, that the two involved should be in agreement.
Do they have a ceremony like we do when they get married?
Yeah, they have three of them. Oh. Phased. Everything in Africa is phased, huh? That's a good point. For example, I mentioned Philip to you yesterday, was ostracized and cursed by his father because he wouldn't accept the wife that the father had given him, because Philip became a Christian and wanted a Christian wife, and this was a traditionalist, and pregnant already by another man, and so forth. And anyway, the elders in the church said, Philip's father was not even a good Mwarush when he did that. He said, not even a good tribesman. Because even in our custom, Philip should agree. It shouldn't be forced on him like that. So that can happen, and it can be, it can work. He never accepted her, and only after 2-3 years are him and his father getting together now to fellowship a bit and so forth. But another case, I was marrying three couples together and was teaching them all, and I remember, and I knew that the one was up from Old Onyewasan, that his father was a strong traditionalist. And I said, okay, what are you doing about this? How about the choice of this woman who's right next to you here now, when I was teaching them? And he said, well, my father is a wise man. He gave me a piece of paper with a list of 5 names on them. He says, any one of these is okay with me. and he said, I chose this one, he said. Well, now, I think that that's a good example of how change happens in Africa. It happens slowly. It happens kind of step by step rather than all at once. If it happens all at once, you'd have problems. Marriage takes place in phases. I'll just tell you the Warush way. There, it's different areas. The Warush way, the first step is when maybe the young people give some suggestion to their parents, and their parents get together and say, let's see if this thing can't work. Huh? And that's just sort of the first stage. The second stage is when the girl may be on the way to the water, river, for water or something, the boy jumps out of the bushes and puts on her a big beaded necklace or something like that. And then she goes home with this and says, so-and-so did it. And that means then that they get a room ready in their house, her house, for him to come and be with her at night. That's the second stage. The third stage is usually in a year or more when his house for her is ready, and they have a big ceremony where they take pots and pans and other things, and they dance their way from where she's living now to this new place, this new house. And that's really sort of the culmination of the thing. Now, it would be interesting for me to hear from you. Where should the church tie into these three phases? Where should the government? Because they now have 120 tribes and one nation, and they want one marriage law. You know, which phase should they tie into? It's a nasty one, isn't it? You'd like to say the second one, huh?
Yeah.
Well, what's wrong with it? What's basically, why are they doing that second one?
To see if she'll get pregnant.
To see if she'll get pregnant.
Yeah.
If she won't, they give her back. And so if you say, tie into that one, you've got problems too, huh? And so the church has usually said, we wait till the last step, huh? And then we have the instruction in the ceremony. I'm sure there are a lot of ways in the world to get married, huh?
The church doesn't exactly wait for the last step, but that's usually the step when the young people will come. They'll just kind of hide away and probably won't be seen for a while, because they're feeling, if they've been in the church and they know the teaching of the church, they're going to feel kind of guilty about it. And then later they'll come and say, yes, we'd like to come and have our marriage blessed.
On the other hand, that's true, Elaine, that's true. And it's really too bad in a way that when their society has patterned it this way, you know. But on the other hand, the church won't have very many happy women in the future if they tie into that second phase and say, this is a trial thing to see if you can get pregnant or not. That isn't going to go over very well in today's world of educated women either.
Are most of your marriages, are they already pregnant? I don't think we had that.
Well, many,
they come with children.
There are a lot of them, they had a kid already, child already.
I don't think we have that until then.
Yeah, well, you see, this, you probably don't have this type of phased marriage like they did among the Mormons. Well,
Here's another question.
Oh, okay.
I was going to say that when I came to California, I was amazed that a lot of the young people where I work have tied into that second thing. So many of the young men and the young women had these trial marriages.
Yeah.
And I was amazed at how many, coming from the Northeast, I just looked down my nose at these people. But it was amazing the number of these young people who did get married.
The last two marriages I had in Bonner's Ferry, I usually don't marry people, but the pastor was gone or something happened. And the last two, they'd been people who'd been living together for quite a while first. And I can live with that coming from Africa, huh? With easier maybe than someone else. But at the same time, there are problems, especially when the women have no rights during that time, should something happen, you know, no legal...
Yes, I was wondering what their opinion was about divorce, whether that's what they do when the wife is unsatisfactory or...
Yeah, there is such a thing as divorce. Their marriage law allows it. Now, there is very little divorce compared to here. Most of the time, the families will try keeping together. And when divorce happens, often, see, you can, well, I can't go into this too much now, but you can get married by a Hindu, by a traditionalist, by a Christian, by a government justice of peace, but it's all the same marriage. And the laws are the same. One law, one certificate for all of these. So there are certain things that divorce has to follow the same way. But it's easier to divorce, for example, if you're a Muslim than it is if you're a Christian and so forth, because the Christian church doesn't always say that the government regulation is what they adhere to. We might want something else.
For those who are not Christian, is there a religious component in that three-stage process of...
Yeah.
When does that insert itself?
All three.
Oh, yes.
A little bit.
Huh? Oh.
Yeah, a little bit all three. For example, the bride wealth would be talked about in the first stage, and then there would be a little bit of it given in the second, and then more in the third, and then more next year, and then the next year. It's a thing that continues for quite a while.
Since they're looking mostly for a male children when they do have children, what is the attitude of the male toward the female other than a childbearing? Do they have respect or are they just...
Yeah, well, of course, you got to think about who you're talking to. You know, if you're talking to the more contemporary, educated African, he's probably just as happy to get a girl as long as he has one boy, particularly, to carry the clan on. When our first grandson was born, first grandchild was born, just the next day I was sitting in the class, or standing in front of my class, and I said, well, you can congratulate me, I have a grandchild. And there were moderate words of approval. And then I said, it's a grandson. And they got up and came up and shook my hand. So it'll take a while. But I don't mean to tell you they don't love their daughters. They do. But they think of their daughters as someone that's going to join another clan, you see. And therefore aren't part of the continuity of the clan. And the clan was very important in their whole concept of creation. Now, many times the creation stories are simply clan stories rather than even tribal stories. All right. Now, I don't want to say much about these other two. I just want to mention uzee. That's a Swahili word which means old age. I'm an mzee. And uzee is the abstract for old age. And it interested me. I didn't know much about this till one day Lane and I were invited up to Mareo, a place about a mile and a half above us, to the village, and said, come and celebrate with us. We got a festive going. So we went up there, and we were drinking tea and talking to people and that. And here, from kind of out of the back of the buildings, behind the trees, comes a broad phalanx of middle-aged men. and they were shuffle dancing down the way and had a chant going, punctuated with shouts, and everyone's watched, and they came and they formed sort of a semicircle, and one of them was a spokesman, and then another spokesman from the old men came forward, and then they exchanged sort of little speeches. And it was what I call a passing of the guard. Huh? It said, now, from now on, middle age bracket will take the burden of the problems and decisions of this village. And you old men will be our washauri, you will be our advisors, but you won't have to do all the work. And I thought that was beautiful. Huh? I liked that. Huh? And the old men still felt important, but yet, they felt real important, because this passing of the guard was also done in a ritualistic way, you know, in which it was important for them to know, now we are of another group, and we won't be called on to settle all the quarrels and everything. Others will do it for us. Regarding death, I would simply say that death comes in phases too in Africa. That's really not true, you know, you die at one time. But burial comes in phases. So there's a burial right away, because there's no embalming. The same day, there's a burial. And then about a month later, they get together and have another thing where the people come and divide this person's tools, for example, his garden tools and all those things are divided. And then 6 months later, they have another one. And then a year and a half later, they have another one. Huh? So the burial is phased as well. And then they become members of the living dead. Those who have gone on before and are still remembered on earth are called Wafu Hai, the living dead. And these are the ones that, in the creed, Jesus descended among the Wafu Hai. Huh? And they say about Jesus that he was a member of the living dead for 2 days. And then he was resurrected to full life. And then, as I said before the first night, that's why in the Eucharist he can come back to us and visit us when we establish this meal. You know, if you remember all this, well, maybe I'll go back over what I said
that's
first night.
That's the Christian interpretation.
What?
That's the Christian interpretation.
Remember, I'll go back and say what I said the first night, and we were sort of looking forward.
I'd like to say something about my tribe.
Yeah.
I'd like to be buried the way they were buried. They used the skin, but I don't care about that. But to be wrapped in a Muslim white robe,
shroud.
Like a shroud. But they dig their grave 6 foot down, and then they dig a little tomb off to the side of that grave. And then when the dead person is put down, they put into that little tomb, and then they take real hard sticks from the woods and pound down, so then the grave is filled up with dirt, but that little tomb stays there. I don't like these expensive funerals around here. That's what I'd like to have.
Right. Thank you. In the light of all this, I got to tell you an experience I had teaching to the Extension Seminary students. We had self-instructional material in Swahili on a 3-year course on basic Christian theology, and one of them had to do with church history. And in that one, we had studied the various ways of looking at the Eucharist, you know, as the real presence, as the Lutherans have said, as a sacrifice, as the Catholics have mentioned a lot, and the memorial as the reform and so forth, you know. And then we said, now, on the back of this piece of paper, you write what you think, as an African, this Holy Communion service means. And Olusike wrote this. He said, well, obviously, Jesus knew that if you're going to have a good life after death, you have to have children to remember you on your grave. Secondly, Jesus knew that he was to be the Messiah who would suffer and die for the sins of the world. He'd never be allowed to have his own family. So he called his followers together, and he established this meal whereby they would remember him. And then then he said, and since Jesus was only a member of the Wafuhai 2 days, he truly is alive, and he can come back every time we celebrate this meal and bless us. Huh? I thought that was... I love to hear at least an African interpretation of something that we've always done in our own way. Huh? Well, let's go on to these just a little bit. Huh? Sacrifice, except for the just daily oblations of milk spilt on the ground and that sort of thing, sacrifice in the bigger rituals is usually for 2 reasons. One, easing the rites of passage. There's always a sort of a sacrificial thing that goes with each one of these. And the other reason is to bring reconciliation when there's been a disruption in the society. You can gather from here, can you not, from what we said already, that sin in their society is mainly a disruption of harmony among themselves. It's thought of in that way. Well, now, when there is a disruption, a fight or someone hurt or something, they have their own way of going about bringing the reconciliation. My colleague Kimere was a Marush, who are also Maasai, just sedentary Maasai, and he said that when like he gave the example of two Marani warriors in the Maasai tribe fighting, getting of two different clans, and they got in a fight that they shouldn't have been in, and I can't remember exactly, I think an eye was gouged out of the one, I don't remember for sure, but it was a serious wound. So they had to take care of this, and they did it again in stages. First the elders of the two clans met and talked this thing over and decided how it should be done. And then they, well, there were a number of things, but they ended up with a big service in which first 2 old men from each of the clans came together and exchanged blankets, you know, the rubega that they wear draped over them. And then 2 mothers who were suckling their children came together and exchanged babies for a while. I don't think for good, but, you know, for a while. And then the 2 men that had fought came together and drew blood on their fingers and licked each other blood in the covenant that this now is over, huh? We're going to be friends. And then they slaughtered a bullock and had a grand time. Everybody had good fun, you know. Now, it's pretty important to see that's quite a reconciliation. You know, they're probably going to remember that a lot longer than when if they go to the justice of the peace about something and he just reads off a statement. So there's something very important about this, and it should continue. Also, it's important in all of these to remember that ritual involves or nothing is ever done just by word. Huh? Nothing is ever only verbal. It's verbal together with acted out ritual. That's why, for example, in Africa, whenever I prayed for a sick person, they knelt and I put my hands on their head. Because touch is part of this. I don't do that in North Idaho simply because the pastor I work with doesn't do this, and he doesn't really want me to. Huh? And we are different here. Huh? But I think they expect touch. They expect ritual. You can see from much of this, too, that it isn't very hard to explain to an African Christian the meaning of a sacrament, because they've lived with a sacramental view of life, where the visible always has an invisible meaning, and the two interpenetrate. And it's quite easy for them to be taught about baptism and the Holy Communion and so forth. And maybe this is the environment in which these things were first instituted, much more than the kind of environment we have here now. As to curses and blessings, the only thing I really want to say is that only certain people are given the authority to give curses and blessings. It's a serious thing because a curse comes from someone who's in a position to be able to do it. And same with a blessing. It just isn't everybody that runs around scattering blessings and curses. But it's the people in the family, in the extended clan, who, according to the structures of that society, have the authority and the power to do it. And once those people do this, that's considered to be done. You know, it happens. And that's why, for example, yesterday we said when Philip was cursed by his father, he was very worried about that. And he came to me and wanted help. And I helped him and I said, in Christ no curse can reach you. And he went and lived with that joyfully for 2 weeks and then came back and said, I know you told me that in Christ no curse can reach you, but tell me again, will you? And this is what a pastor is for, huh? This is what the church is for, because we are always people in need of this assurance of the love of God coming to us to conquer over evil.
Who among the tribe assigns the duty of curse or bless? Are there significant people?
Oh, yes. And it isn't really that someone is assigned by democratic vote. It's usually something that comes through probably a family has had people of authority in this so long that it'll follow family lines. But I can't say that for sure, because that'll be different with different ethnic groups. You can see what it means for the Christian church regarding ordination, can't you? When people have a view like that, ordination is very important to them. The man that stands up and gives a blessing afterward, who is he, huh? How'd he get there? And so forth, and so on. And administers the community.
Did that father know that you negated that curse?
The father and I were the best of friends for a long time until this rupture came between him and his son. And for a while he was pretty cold toward me, but towards the end we were talking again, huh? And he surely knew that I said this, but he cursed me as well, and Elaine, because we had been part of, when he ostracized his son, we were friends to his son, see? And he became angry and cursed a lot of people. Even his own tribal people thought he went overboard on this. He, by the way, was the main herbalist. He was the one who mainly knew which medicines in the forest were right for certain diseases. One of my sons did a medicinal study, a medicinal plant study under him at one time.
Now, did he have the authority to give curses according to the tribe?
Yes, according to him he did, according to the tribe and the family. More than tribe in a situation like that, it would be family, the extended clan that gives this. Well,
as a pastor, wasn't it difficult to learn their language?
Not too bad. Swahili is a pretty good language, you know. We didn't have to learn the tribal tongue because we worked with different tribes, so we learned Swahili. You know how that happened, don't you? When the Arabs came to East Africa in the slave trade and other trade, they did not bring their Arab wives. And being Muslims, they also could marry others. So they married African wives and settled usually along the coast. And out of those homes comes a language which is part African and part Arabic, and it's called Swahili. The phonetics and the phonemics follow the African language, but about maybe a fourth to a third of the vocabulary is Arabic. And it followed the trade routes and very early, the slave routes really, and very early became the trade language. And then later the educational language, and then finally when they became an independent country, the national language. That doesn't mean these other languages are forgotten. Not at all. They speak them at home all the time, but they know Swahili. The only ones that don't know Swahili are probably now some of the older women out in the hinterlands, huh? Who don't know it much. But it's a rather marvelous gift. Out of a horrible thing like the slave trade, they get a gift that kind of unites them as a nation. That's one of the advantages of Tanzania over Kenya. Kenya never took to Swahili because they had so many English people up there. In some ways they went to English from the vernacular. And that's awful to eat crow like that, to say now we're an independent country, but our national language is that of our colonial power. So they said, no, our national language is English too, but the trouble is some of their parliamentarians didn't know how to talk it.
Their national language is Swahili.
It's Swahili now, excuse me, yeah. And but you were given, when we go there, we were given 3 months to just live with another family and learn, and then you go and hopefully someone else is there to help you little by little. It's a real nice language, a good language. You can express a lot of things in it. Any other questions or comments? Yeah?
How are the wives treated over there in comparison with American couples? Are they treated like slaves that does all the work?
No, I wouldn't say that. You know, I think that they got, I mentioned yesterday, that I think they get an undue percentage of the workload. Partly because, you know, when the division of labor was given, they said, you get the firewood, you get the water, and you cook the food, and you cultivate. Well, getting the water and the firewood wasn't so hard when it was right around them, outside their door. And then you get population pressures, and all of a sudden they got to walk half a day to get some of these things. But that's correcting itself. It's correcting itself through education and through the church. For example, we have a dear friend who is a pastor in the Babati area, but he's a man from the Southern Highlands, and they never had any daughters, I believe, or had mostly, pardon?
Didn't have older daughters.
Yeah, they didn't have any older daughters, they had just sons. So he sent his son to the river to get water. And the people refused. They said, you can't carry water, that isn't done. And he had to go there and say, in my family, it's done. Huh? And here again, I think this is the way change happens.
Do they have any transportation over there of any kind that helps improve some of these chores that they have to do?
Bicycles, oxen, ox carts.
I have
a donkey.
And a donkey?
You have the donkeys.
I have a slide that I show in my presentation where the man of the house made his homemade cart. Uh-huh. Made a homemade cart, and he has oxen on it, and he filled that homemade cart with kindling wood, piled it way up, and brought it home for his wife.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's progress.
And really, we see, especially amongst the Christians, we can tell case after case where the young man and the woman, I mean, they really do work together. We have wonderful examples of that.
I remember
even with the non-Christians, I mean, it's just like here. Some men really love their wives and they work side by side, and others treat their wives as just kind of.
I remember this other gentleman was with us the first part of the week, Rube. He was missionary there before I came, and I remember he told me one of the first things in 1952 or 3 when I came, he said, you can usually tell the difference between a Christian and a non-Christian kraal. And I said, how? And he says, well, in the Christian kraal, you'll see the man out with the woman hoeing the corn. Mm-hmm. And so there are changes, you know, they come along. I wouldn't say that's all over, but you can along with the question marks you have regarding the culture, you can see a lot of richness here, can't you?
Mm-hmm.
Oh man, tremendous. And I've got a verse here. I was gonna, I must have hid it away. I was reading the other day in Ephesians, and I came across this verse, Ephesians 3:10. So that through the church, the wisdom of God in its rich varieties might now be made known. Huh? I think that's what World Missions is all about. Whenever the gospel is proclaimed in a culture, in a society, then the church is enriched because the gospel takes root in that culture, and some of these very good things are simply enhanced, and some of the more unpleasant things are declining, hopefully. Huh? And yet, we have to, as a church, be open to the wisdom of God in this variety of experience from around the world. Whenever you send anyone to proclaim the gospel to a people, you should expect to get back 100-fold in riches as Christ becomes real to those people in that area. The vanguard of selective change in Africa as far as I can see, is the church elders. They meet monthly and they decide, here are things in our society we want to keep, we want to bless them, we want to make them strong. Here are things we want to, in ways that we can sort of denigrate and get rid of them. And they're the ones that are doing it. This one first and then you.
Language-wise, is it hard to get these things over by using their language?
No.
They have words that are comparable.
Yeah, you have to use words. You see, you have to use words even for God. You have to decide, what are you going to use? The word for sun or the word for light? But you have help. No missionary just comes and does that on his own. He meets with people of their own tribe. One of the marks of the Christian mission to the world is that we have translated into thousands of languages the scriptures, the catechisms, the liturgies, and we're the first in most cases to write these languages down in an alphabet and make them into organizing them into a grammar. And this language is the soul of the people. So then other things are written in that language. Other things become important. And it enhances their indigenous culture. And the church is also enhanced. Even Luther's small catechism has been translated into 70, 75 languages, I think.
I worked on a committee on translating the Gospel of Mark. I'm going to make it brief.
Yeah.
But when it was finally finished, one of the two ladies held up that Gospel of Mark, and she said, now God hears us in our language.
Yeah.
How many can read?
Well, I think they say about 70%. Now, I don't know if they've got the statistics right, but they're definitely getting more and more on it all the time. And there are adult literacy. What
I would even say a higher percentage.
Yeah, they probably. Yeah, we.
All the children are go to school.
Yeah. Well, not quite. They go, when there's a school in the area, the children have to go to school. If the government and the people haven't gotten a school there yet, then obviously they can't go there. But they're making great strides. All right, my question now is, we've got 7 minutes, and the topic on the board for today is ELCA and cultural diversity. But what do you think we can learn from our experience in another culture, in cross-cultural mission, for our church today, whose desire is to be really inclusive, you know, Native Americans, African Americans, Spanish, and all this, you know, and subcultures of one kind or another. What do you think we can learn from the way things were done in Africa and the way the church has grown?
What I was going to say, cultural change comes very slowly. An analogy you could use is boiling outside in a cooking kettle.
Yeah.
And what you're boiling is the new, and what spills over
is the old.
Is the old, and it's a gradual process.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
Well, it seems to me that when you said, you come with something that has value and you place it in here. But I think that what we're seeing very often in working with other cultures, and I'm thinking particularly of African American and Hispanic, much of the culture of the African American has been lost, and they're trying to retrieve it, and they're not quite sure what of that they want to. And then the earlier culture of theirs in America isn't necessarily something they wanted, so that when we insist that we go back to where they were, how many African Americans are eating collards and chitlings and things that they had to eat because of the poverty of slavery,
right.
And to insist that that's their culture, it's really phony.
That's right. And the other thing we said when we talked, we had one day where we talked about culture. And one of the things we said is that we always remember cultures are always changing. Mm-hmm. This business about that you set up like people that tell us when we come home, don't change the African, don't change whatever you're doing, don't change it. They're changing simply from forces within themselves and from extra forces from the outside. That's always true. But they shouldn't be forced change, another culture imposed on them. It should be working like the boiling pot, as he said.
And we must get away from thinking that we have the best.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think that the best thing we could do on that imaginary day we don't have, is to ask ourselves, what are the characteristics of our dominant culture in America? Let's forget about the Native American, the African American for us. Let's say our dominant culture, what are its characteristics? How sacrosanct are they? Are there ways in which we need a change? Is the gospel the ferment that it should be through the Christian people of America to effect change even in our culture? And if you want a book on that, that is really well worth it, it's in the library, I had it ordered. It's this one by Newbegin, Foolishness to the Greeks. He's a British missiologist who has a background like this we're talking about, and he has a message for Western culture. And that's what I think, in a way, one of the things a study like this should do is to make us alert to the fact that our culture is also changing. That there is no culture in the world, as far as Christian theology is concerned, that comes in other than through repentance and faith. Nobody is in the church just because they're a minority culture or just because they're the dominant culture through which the church came. Still, repentance and faith in Christ are the criteria through which people come in, and then they have a new way to evaluate some of the things when they look at them. The life-giving, the death-giving Carl has been talking about every morning for this week, for example. We're all doing things like that.
Well, and it was like your statement last year that the Christian church is just one generation from paganism.
Yeah, well, that's always true. You know, We used to call African churches the younger churches until they finally pointed out that that's biblically phony. Every church is one step away from unbelief and death. And it's interesting that you don't build on the prophets and the apostles in one generation, and the next generation builds from the windowsills up. Every generation builds from the apostles and the prophets. And our church is as old as we are, as far as that is concerned. Any other thing? Comments? You're looking real.
Just squirrely.
Yeah. Our pastor wants to change the liturgy in our church. He says that we're not attracting enough young people, and a lot of people come and can't follow in the books, and they think it's kind of a cold. He wants to make up things on the printer there and pass them out and have everything there. But he says, we got to liven it up. I says,
blessings on him, try everything. He's not going to settle all the problems of the world with that one either, I can tell you that right now.
But I'm a real true Lutheran, but you don't want to change your liturgy, you want to follow it.
Yeah. Right.
Just like the Catholics do. They don't change their liturgy for the young people.
Well, the thing is, change is part of that even in liturgy. Just don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
As long as the basic thing is,
right,
never changes.
Right. And the basic thing when it comes down to everything is Jesus Christ. Right. That's what we started about. We started talking about Jesus Christ. Why do you consider him with all other cultures rather than Moses or Muhammad or somebody else? And for us, that's very important. We believe that the decisive word from God has come to us in Christ. We don't brag about it, we live it all the time, but our focus is there. And we don't want to throw them out. Well, thank you very much. I've enjoyed this.
Thank you.
It's been fun.